From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Rupert Thompson, whose new novel is Barcelona Dreaming, published by The Other Press. Rupert Thompson is the author of 12 highly acclaimed novels, including Catherine Carlyle, Secrecy, The Insult, which was shortlisted for the Guardian Fiction Prize and selected by David Bowie as one of his 100 must-read books of all time, The Book of Revelation, which was made into a feature film by Anna Kokinos, and Death of a Murderer, which was shortlisted for the Costa Novel of the Year Award. His memoir, This Party's Got to Stop, was named Writers Guild Nonfiction Book of the Year. He lives in London. Here's a little information about Barcelona Dreaming. Set on the eve of the financial crash of 2008, the novel is made up of three stories linked by time and place, and also by the moving, unexpected interactions of a rich cast of characters. Barcelona Dreaming is narrated in turn by an English woman who runs a gift shop, an alcoholic jazz pianist, and a translator tormented by unrequited love, all of whose lives will be changed forever. Underpinning the novel and casting a long shadow is a crime committed against a young Moroccan immigrant. I began by asking Rupert Thompson to talk about what inspired Barcelona Dreaming and how he found the threads of the three stories that unfold in the novel. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
This book began in a really unusual way. I was living in Barcelona. I'd moved there in 2004. And then 2008, 2009, the financial crash happened. And we suddenly realized that because I'd been living from English pounds changed into euros, and suddenly the exchange rate changed. So everything for me became 30% more expensive within the space of 2 weeks. So it became really clear that we were going to have to leave the city. And I'd completely fallen in love with the place. I've lived in a lot of places in the world, but for some reason, Barcelona, I'd become kind of embedded in the place, and I didn't want to leave. And so the knowledge that I would have to, I became quite low about it, quite depressed, and every evening, because I worked in this rather strange office, it was in a convent at the back of the city, so very high up, and I actually gave a donation to the nuns rather than pay rent. So my rent was a kind of donation to the Catholic Church.
Oh, wow.
In any case, I would come out, you know, I would leave my office every evening, and then I would walk down three hills to get home. And at the top of the first of these hills, I'd be able to see the whole city of Barcelona laid out below me, half of it in sunlight, half in shadow, because the sun would be setting behind me. And I would look at the place and I would think, you must remember this, because soon you're not going to be able to see it anymore. And this was kind of heartache, you know, this was a kind of, I had this nostalgia already for something that wasn't even over yet.
Right.
And it was out of this feeling, this kind of really exquisite and painful feeling that I was going to have to leave this place I loved, that the book came, because in the last, I suppose in the last 2 months, the last 3 months maybe that I was living in the city, I suddenly thought, I'm going to write about the city before I go. I'm going to write about it while I'm still here. And from one day to the next, I started. And all I had was one thing. And it was based on the previous office I'd had, which was a room with no windows above an underground car park. So basically, I would leave the door of the office open, because if I didn't, I would use up all the air during the course of the working day and I'd basically kind of fall asleep sometime in the afternoon. So I'd leave this door open and sounds would come up from the underground car park below, really, really clearly, like the chinking of someone's keys as they got them out to open their car door, or a little snatch of conversation on a mobile phone, you know, on a cell phone. And I started the Barcelona book with that image, you know, the image of someone, I turned myself into a woman and I was woken in the middle of the night by the sound of someone crying.
Right.
By the sound of a man crying, actually. And I placed this woman's fictional apartment above an underground car park. So she was on the ground floor. The car park was underneath. And this sound was coming up from the car park. And she knew it was coming. She knew where it was coming from. And so she simply, as you know, and you've read the story, she puts on her clothes quickly and goes to see who it is.
Yeah.
And that's all I had. And it flowed from there.
It's interesting, though, because as you describe what you loved looking out from that hill, I'm reminded of, you write this on page one. Do you mind if I read something?
Sure. I'd like to hear someone else read it.
Yeah. You write, "The quality of the light first thing in the morning, so bright and clear that the buildings seemed to have black edges." That really struck me when I read that. And then, you know, you also write the green parrots that flashed from one palm tree to another, long walks in the Colserola?
Colserola.
Yeah.
It's pretty much as it sounds. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, those two L's, I never am sure if that is Catalan, though.
Yeah, in Catalan, it would just sound like two L's, It depends on where it is in the word. In that case, yeah.
But anyway, you definitely captured that light being special, and that was interesting when you just told
me. I think that starting with that story, one of the things I had to think about was, I mean, what was curious about it, because I say I started with this, you know, sound of someone crying in the middle of the night. And then these stories followed very quickly, one after the other. And I was just in preparation for this interview, I was looking at the first drafts of those stories, which were written in 2010, as I said, you know, so 11 years ago now. And it's really strange, but the basic stories are already there in each case. You know, I mean, what I did was rewrote, and the sentences hopefully got better. And that kind of thing. But the stories were there, and it was curious because I then had to work out how I would arrange them in the book. And one of the reasons why the Giant of Sarria, you know, the story about the woman who runs the gift shop, is at the front of the book is because it starts in that way, you know, because you get a sense of her talking about the city she didn't want to leave.
Yeah.
So it's very much like the kind of thing that I was feeling, you know, that feeling that when you live somewhere and you walk out of the front door in the morning to do something very ordinary and your spirits lift, you know, your heart sings simply because you're in that place. You know, my heart does not sing when I go out of the door in London. It never has, really. It's sang in other places, but Barcelona really had that effect on me. And it was really the simple things. Yeah. It really was, you know, it really was the quality of light, the smell of the air, you know, the those things that you in most other places kind of take for granted or don't even think about.
One thing I found very interesting was that you sort of establish Amy's character. Amy is the narrator in the first story. And you sort of establish her character by having her sort of think about what she's looking at and all the little details that she sees around her. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, I felt like I started to get to know her before there was any dialogue, before there was any character interaction, because she's just noticing all these things. And I loved getting to know her by way of what she chose to notice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, she also, I think you get to know her by also through her, it's not so much what she thinks or says, it's what she actually does. It's what you see her doing.
Awesome.
So even the very idea of Amy is 40, I see her as 41, 42, maybe 43, you know, very early 40s. And, you know, the idea of putting on your clothes and going down to investigate in the middle of the night is already, it already tells you quite a lot about her.
Right.
You know,
so oh, definitely.
Even though she is observing things, you're also observing her. And,
right.
And, You're getting to know her by seeing what she does. And, you know, I guess that's a very basic thing about fiction writing anyway, is the idea of, you know, the thing people always talk about in fiction writing classes, the idea of show, not tell. You know, so you don't say Amy is a brave woman. You show her being brave.
And
she's that right from the beginning. You know, she enters into something, she enters into a relationship which is really... you know, which is a kind of form of madness in a way. You might look back on it and think of it that way,
right.
But she doesn't see it that way.
Right. It's absolutely a relationship that's taboo in the community around her, as you show us. I wonder, is this a good time maybe for you to read from that story?
Yeah.
Great.
It's a three-page section.
That's,
is that all right?
That's wonderful. Yeah.
And I'll just set it up briefly because Amy has been woken up by the sound of a man crying in the middle of the night, and she goes down to the underground car park beneath where she lives, and she finds a young Moroccan man in distress. He seems to be 19 or 20. He's dressed up nicely, but he's crying. He's leaning on the bonnet of the car crying. And she basically says, "Are you all right?" And takes him back into her apartment, even though it's the middle of the night, and sits him down and gives him a cup of tea and, you know, allows him to calm down and to feel better about things, maybe, or so she thinks. And then when he's kind of ready, she sort of takes him out of the apartment and gives him money to get a cab home. And, you know, she sort of thinks that's the end of it. She took a bit of a risk to taking him into the apartment. But she's helped him, and now he's gone, and hopefully he'll be all right. 4 days later, he turns up outside her apartment with these shopping bags, and he announces that he wants to cook for her as a way of thanking her. So this is what happens next. Great. His name was Abdul Ben Tajar, he told me, and he was from Tangier. He'd been living in Barcelona for about 6 months. Before that, he was in Almeria. He had learned to cook when his mother was knocked down in the street and broke her arm. He was 14 then. As the eldest of three children, he had to take over in the kitchen. His mother would issue instructions from a nearby chair. "No, not like that," he said, imitating her. "Cut into smaller pieces. Stir more slowly. You forgot the salt." He was smiling. He hadn't seen her in almost 3 years. She was still back home in Morocco. That evening, Abdul cooked a lamb tagine. He'd arrived with everything that he would need, not just the meat, but the tomatoes, the onions, dried apricots, fresh coriander, and his own herbs and spices wrapped in twists of rough brown paper. He even brought a terracotta cooking pot with a lid. We ate at a small table on my terrace. I lit candles and opened a bottle of Rioja. As a Muslim, Abdul was content with fruit juice. His Spanish was no more sophisticated than my French, and he didn't have any English at all, but we had no trouble communicating. I asked him about Morocco, a country I'd never visited. His father's family were Bedouin, he said. They lived in the mountains to the south of Marrakesh. He was open and talkative, nothing like the tense, wary person I'd come across in the small hours of Thursday morning. He didn't seem to find it awkward to be alone with a woman from a different culture, a woman he barely knew, and I caught myself hoping it wasn't on account of my age. At least once that evening, while in the bathroom, I leaned close to the mirror, examining my face. People were always telling me how young I looked, how me and my daughter Ma could easily be sisters, but that was just something people said, wasn't it? On my way back to the terrace, I paused in the shadows at the far end of the living room. I could see Abdul through the sliding glass door, gazing out into the night, with his chin propped on one hand. He looked at home, at ease. The fact that I'd met him when he was at his lowest had given him, paradoxically, a kind of strength. After all, in his own eyes, he would never be less of a man than he'd been on that first night. It grew late, but the idea that he should leave didn't occur to him. His complacency made me smile, and I had to turn away so he didn't notice. I didn't want him thinking I was mocking him. Busying myself at the sink, I told him I had to be up early in the morning, and that it was probably time he went home. With anyone else, this would have been rude. Not with him, somehow. He stretched lazily, as if he had also drunk a little too much Rioja. Then he gathered up his cooking pot, which I had washed, and his remaining herbs and spices, and packed them into the carrier bag he'd brought with him. Once I'd showed him out of my apartment, we stood on the thin strip of pavement at the front of the building. Aware that my neighbor's living room window was open, I stepped closer to Abdul and spoke in a low voice. I thanked him for cooking for me. He nodded, then studied his feet. For the first time that evening, he seemed on edge, as if he was waiting for something. and I remembered how on Thursday night I'd given him cab fare. He was too embarrassed to bring it up, perhaps. "Do you need money to get home?" I asked. "I'll take the metro," he said, "or a bus." He turned away, but then turned back. "Did you think about me?" "I'm sorry." I wasn't sure I'd understood. "Did you think about me on Thursday night after I had gone?" His eyes were earnest and sober, as if the matter troubled him. But I still couldn't work out what he was asking. Before I had time to answer, he spoke again. "I thought about you." A car came up the narrow street with its headlights on full beam. And as I half closed my eyes against the glare, one of its wing mirrors clipped my thigh. I let out a faint cry, but the car was already past me and turning onto Avinguda Foch. Abdul put a hand on my upper arm near the shoulder. "Are you all right?" "I'm fine," I said. "It was a shock, that's all." His hand remained where it was, his gaze intent, unfathomable. He seemed older just then, and I thought I could imagine how he might age, threads of white in those dark curls and fine lines at the edges of his eyes and mouth, but still something extraordinary to look at. "Really," I said, "it was nothing." I looked away from him, but felt his gaze rest on me for a moment longer. Then he took his hand from my arm and walked off down the street in the direction of the metro station. I stood and watched him go, his head poised, almost afloat in the air. After what he had said, I could feel my heart beating. It had slowed down and seemed at the same time to have become more powerful, more urgent. And I thought he might look over his shoulder, just a glance. But he didn't, not even once.
Thank you very much for reading that. I thought that was a great section to read, actually. It's great because they're just starting to get to know each other, although they've had a very sort of intense beginning to their friendship. I don't want to give anything away, but I do want to talk a little bit, if I may, about the car clipping her. And just I will just say that there is there's a kind of repetition of vehicles coming toward people in this, and I wanted to know if you built upon that after writing one of these moments, or if you knew ahead of time that you were going to have a few of these kinds of moments in the piece.
I'm a completely intuitive writer. So, you know, when I write the first draft of something, I really have no idea where I'm going with it. Okay. I certainly have no idea of the end, and I really have not much idea of the journey that's going to be involved. And in fact, I think that's one of the things I really love most about the process, you know, the fact that it's an exploration every time at first draft stage. So oddly enough, those things were already there in the first draft. And what happens, of course, with an intuitive writer is you necessarily become more you know, you obviously become more rational and more objective as you move on with the manuscript. And I'm someone who writes many drafts of a book. You know, this one went through 13, each story went through at least 13 different drafts from beginning to end, and also internally I would go back and forward. So, you know, obviously at some stage you begin to realize what's there and you start working with it. I didn't, however, I've never realized what you just said. I didn't know about the vehicles. I mean, it hasn't occurred to me until just now. The fact that, you know, she's clipped by a car very early in the story, and then there's a very important car later in the story, in the same story. And it sort of brings me to, you know, there's something about fiction, which is, I like to quote Louise Bourgeois, the French artist, who said, "I trust my unconscious 100%. My unconscious is my friend." She's talking about it in relation to her work. And I think as a fiction writer, you have to have that trust, because you have to assume, you know, there are a million decisions to be made on every page when you write a piece of fiction, and you can't possibly make all those rationally. Some of them just have to be intuitive and have to kind of remain intuitive, and you have to trust what's there. And it's also, you know, the point of fiction is that someone like you, a reader, will see something I never saw. You know, this is part of what fiction is about. You know, it's the relationship between two people, and there's the book in the middle. And, you know, the writer may never meet that person or talk to them, but that relationship still exists, you know, and that magic still happens.
Yeah. I think
thank you for pointing that out.
No, but you know, and the other thing is, and you haven't mentioned this, but there's also a motorcycle.
Yes, there is.
Right? And it's interesting to me that these...
And there are vehicles in the other stories now, I think, about it.
Yeah. You know,
I'm now going to have, after this is over, I'm going to go back and start looking for them.
But they start to accrue meaning, whether you intentionally set out to have them, you know, it's sort of like she was being brave. You don't write that. Well, nor do you sort of... infuse these events with overt meaning. They just are, and I enjoyed that very much.
Well, there's something very organic, I think, about fiction writing when it's working, you know, and it just grows, and there's something natural about it, you know, and it's not forced. And the problem I had with this book, because there are three stories, you know, we haven't really talked about this yet, but there are three separate stories of pretty much equal length. Weirdly, they always were of roughly equal length. I don't know why, but they were roughly, you know, 15, 20,000 words each. And they are automatically connected by time and place. You know, they're all set in Barcelona, and they're all set just pre the crash, you know, they're set in those years, the early 2000s. And, you know, that in a way, that's enough to connect them. But of course, they're also connected by characters who move between the stories. So someone who's a major character in one may pass through a room in one of the other stories. And something I had to be really careful of in the late stages, and in fact, I went too far with this at one point, was to try and connect the stories over much, you know, to make too many connections. So actually, I had to start removing them at a certain point. And I had to trust the fact that simply the fact of time and place was in itself enough.
Why did you feel that more than that would be too much?
Because it began to look like I was manipulating the material. You know, it was sort of the fiction writer trying to be super clever, and thinking, I could, now there's that there, I could do this here, and there could be a connection, and maybe no one will get it, but I'll know it's there. And I just felt like it wasn't necessary for the project, you know. I mean, the fact is, the young Moroccan man who we've just heard about, you know, a crime has been committed against him. This is why he was crying in the underground car park. And that crime actually runs through all three stories. I mean, it casts a strange long shadow over the book. And, you know, that I loved the way, even though it's hardly touched on in one of the stories, it's only alluded to very obliquely, it's still there, you know, and somehow it casts a shadow forwards through the book, you know. And that I really liked. So I didn't want too many connections with characters doing things and, you know, meeting each other by chance. I preferred the idea that they might just miss each other, you know, that a character in one story might walk down a street in Barcelona and walking the other way is a character from another story, but they don't see each other and they don't know each other and they don't know they were there. So, you know, there's that feeling about life is often like that, you know.
Yeah, and it's always rather engaging to find out. You know, I remember when I was in college, the Dalai Lama came and spoke at my college, and the man who I later married told me he had been there in that same, you know, huge audience. And it's just, you know, those kinds of things where, you know, there's just like life.
Oh, I love those. Yeah, I love those kind of stories. I used to have this idea of, I fantasized about having a map of my entire life. So you'd have a map of the world, and there'd be some places where you just had one little red line of where you'd been because it was somewhere you were only once. But the places where you'd lived, you'd have to have blown up huge scale, you know, because there'd be a mass of red lines, obviously, because you're going up and down the street every day. But then you would compare your map with someone else's map, and you'd find there were places and times when you'd almost brushed again, you'd brushed past each other and you hadn't known, you know.
Actually, you could probably do that with Google.
So. You probably could. You'd need a computer, obviously, because can you imagine what the pieces of paper would look like?
Exactly. let's talk about some of the other two stories. The second story concerns Nacho, and you move from the past tense to the present tense. No, I'm sorry. Amy's story is told in the past tense. Nacho's story is told in the present tense. And then in the final story with Jordy, you go back to the past tense. Now, this is not specifically about these stories, but I'm just curious why you made that decision. Did it feel like present tense? I think as I read Nacho's story, it felt absolutely like the right decision.
It's only the beginning and the end of the story that are in the present tense. In Nacho's case, the main story is told in the past tense, okay. but he begins and ends in the present tense because I want this idea of, because he's someone, I mean, Nacho, we haven't explained who he is, but he's an alcoholic.
Oh, you're right. He does go into the past tense through that whole thing.
No, but you see, I'm interested that you have the idea that the story is in the present tense, because in a way there is a kind of present tense in his state of mind. You know, because he's basically a deluded person. Right. I mean, he is an alcoholic and he is in denial about what's happening to him. And the story basically revolves around his friendship, which is almost certainly imaginary, with a very famous footballer. Who is a real person called Ronaldinho, the great Brazilian footballer who played for the Barcelona football team, you know, at that time. So Ronaldinho was living in the city and it was possible to see him. I mean, I did see him once in a bar, you know, so these people were there. But Nacho is kind of like, to me, he's very like, I don't know if you know the John Cheever story, The Swimmer.
I know.
There's a famous black and white movie of it with Burt Lancaster.
Oh, Burt Lancaster, not Bacharach.
Yeah, Bacharach. I could have done the music.
Yeah, wrong Burt.
But you know, The Swimmer is a story of self-delusion because it's a man whose wife has left him and taken the children, and he basically swims home. He's at a cocktail party and everyone had a pool. He's in the suburbs, and so he decides to swim home, and he goes from one pool to another, you know, mostly people he knows and sometimes people he doesn't know. He just appears in there, swims across their pool and then carries on. And of course, arrives back at the house that is his to find that it's completely deserted, the tennis court's overgrown, you know, there are dead leaves and there's no one there.
Right.
And it's a tragic story, you know, it's really effective. And in a way, Nacho, not when I was first writing the story, but later on, I began to see there were kind of similarities because he's someone who can't break out of this pattern of self-delusion. You know, he has a relationship with a younger Brazilian woman, but he's obviously, it's suggested in the story that he's mistreating her, abusing her, even though he loves her. And yet he can't admit that to himself.
Right. It's interesting. I was thinking of him just sort of from the perspective of the craft of writing, I was thinking of him as an unreliable narrator, but I prefer thinking of him as self-deluded. I mean, it's a more accurate expression of what's happening to him. It's not purposeful. He's...
Well, you know, the famous alcoholic's excuse, which is always, if you say to an alcoholic, you said that terrible thing to me last night, you know, when you were drunk, you said, I can't believe what you said to me. And the alcoholic always says, did I? I can't remember, you know, and it's always I can't remember that is the excuse. And they kind of hope that lets them off the hook. It's as if that somehow will let them off the hook. So there's kind of inbuilt denial. And in Nacho's case, I guess that's what the present tense at the beginning and the end are about. It's the fact that he's stuck in a place and he can't move forwards and he can't break out of it. Right. You know, if I'd ended in a... Somehow the present tense tells you that he's trapped.
And now that you've pointed out to me what I did not notice while I was reading it, which is that it sort of bookends the story of what's happened to him in recent years, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, ending it in the present tense kind of, it does imprison him in that moment, right?
Yeah, because you get the sense with Nacho that he was someone who was really the life and soul of the party. He was like a great guy when he was in his 20s and 30s. Because, you know, he was in a jazz band and he was attractive and he had all these relationships and he ran a restaurant. And, you know, he was, it's almost as if he started out wide and as he's aged, he's narrowed, you know, and he's narrowed into a place that he can't get out of.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you give him as a way to be alive and be able to afford his life. He's inherited money. from, I guess, some sort of entrepreneurial, was it a real estate deal that his
He has a school friend who he goes into business with. So he hasn't quite inherited it. He's more
He's more like kind of made
the money, but he hasn't really done the work.
And it's paid off for a very, very long time. And I thought that was so appropriate because there's just nothing that he needs to, even earning a living isn't something that will motivate him out of his present situation. You know, he doesn't really need to, which seems right.
I think it's also, in a way, it's the most tragic story of the three, but it's also, I think, the funniest, you know, because there are some great moments, like when he's driving back half naked, you know, from trying to get his girlfriend back, you know, he thinks he's driving up to see his girlfriend, who's staying in a town north of Barcelona, to get away from him because he's been violent. And he thinks, I'm going to show her how much I love her by, you know, I'm going to turn up like a white knight, you know, on a charger and carry her back to Barcelona. And of course he gets it all wrong and ends up being thrown out and, you know, and he spills stuff on his shirt and then he drives home half naked and gets stopped by the police, you know, and so the police are sort of looking at him thinking, who on earth is this guy?
Right, exactly.
And he has really no concept, you know, you only find out by accident.
I loved this.
And he's got no clothes on.
You're saying it's kind of funny. I laughed out loud and read this to my husband. I loved this. This is it. And actually, it is different here, but only in detail. I'll tell you. When Christiani moved in, her 7-year-old son, Aristides, came with her, like one of those supermarket deals where you get a free mug with a wedge of Parmesan.
I did think that was funny.
That was very funny. And we don't get a mug with a wedge of Parmesan. It would be more like, I don't know what it would be. What would we get? You know, just a second wedge of Parmesan, probably.
It's a very Spanish thing. I mean, that was actually, I did, because we bought an awful lot of Parmesan when we were living there, I ended up with a whole set of mugs, you know.
That's funny. Let me ask you this. In both of the first two stories, and probably the third one too, although I'm not thinking of that right now, but you write a story within the story. In the case of Amy's story, her daughter comes to visit. And that's sort of an interesting way that the story progresses. And I have a question about that later. In Nacho's story, you write about his relationship with a woman named Elsa Slump. And at first, it just seems like this is going to be a passing mention of an affair that he had with a woman that he was in a band with. But then it comes back and we really get she has a larger role to play in the story than it seemed at first. And I wondered if you could talk about that decision. I thought that was interesting.
I'm not sure where that came from, except that I know exactly where the name Elsa Slump came from, because I'm one of those people who pick things up on the street if I think they look interesting. And it was actually only about 2 or 3 miles from where I live on a bridge in London. And I was walking along and I saw a name card, one of those business cards. Uh-huh. It was upside down. So I couldn't see who it was, you know, so I picked it up and turned it over and it said Elsa Slump. And I thought, I can't remember what she did or who she was, but it was just the most extraordinary name. And I thought, I couldn't have made that up. I have to use that at some point. You know? So it was one of those things you remember. But that story, I think what it does is it humanizes Nacho. You know, it makes him into someone who is sort of capable of empathy and even love, someone who is sort of human, someone who will put himself out for someone else. Because I think there's a sense in the present tense of the story that he's become like a bit of a monster, you know, that he, as I say, you know, he's narrowed into a place where he isn't in denial about what he's doing, and what he's doing isn't necessarily very nice.
He's like a caricature of himself in a way.
Yeah, he's become overblown, you know, like an overblown version of himself. And yet he can't admit that because it would be too kind of shameful. So going back to him in his 20s and 30s is a way of saying, you know, this is actually also him. This is who he could be. Well, it's who he was, and it's also who he could be again if he was to break out of this pattern. And I think it's not that I want my characters you know, I don't want them to be likable because I don't think that's necessary for fiction. You know, I don't think every character in a novel or a short story has to be likable. They have to be interesting, you know, but not likable. And so, but there was an aspect of sort of trying to show the range that he had as a character. And there was something about that relationship with someone, you know, his relationship with this kind of tortured singer that showed that. And I also, actually, some of my favorite writing is in the book is in that description of his relationship with her, because it's quite surreal and quite almost poetic, you know, the description of how he is with her. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a very odd character. You know, she keeps goldfish in bowls in her bedroom because in case there's an earthquake, so she can see the water tilt. And you know, she goes to bed with her shoes on. And you know, she's not your average jazz singer necessarily.
I don't know that there is an average jazz singer.
No. Right. Maybe she is. Maybe she's, you know.
Maybe she's the model for all.
Yeah.
No, you do, I don't mean to say similar, but another interesting thing. In the third story, which, as I said, concerns a man named Jordy, and he's a translator, and you give this story within the story. He has to translate a novel called Giving, and you create a whole plot for that novel. You kind of, and you give it to us, the whole plot, not in prose, but just an explanation of what he's working on. And I thought that was really interesting, especially because Jordy feels like it's a hard book to translate just because of the nature of it. It's full of innuendo and subtlety that he's finding hard to translate into this, you know, into, I guess, Spanish. I can't remember what
it's also kind of claustrophobic and yeah. Quite brutal, isn't it, the story?
Right. And then he does say that he feels like it's sort of reflecting his own life in certain ways. So it was just interesting. How was it for you to come up with that other plot? Was that fun?
Once I had the idea of a translator, I just thought he needs to be working on something.
Right.
You know, because we need to hear about his life and we need to know what it's like. And so that story came quite quickly. And in fact, my brother just read Barcelona Dreaming the other day. I gave him an early copy. And he said, it's very interesting in that third story how he more or less said what you just said. Very interesting how you have that whole short book inside a story. And he said, did you ever think of writing that book?
I wondered that,
you know,
too.
Did you ever think of writing that story as a book? And funnily enough, I have thought of that. And I suddenly thought, you know, I could actually write that as a novella and publish it. And I don't know whether I'd have to publish it under the French writer's name. I don't really want to do something under a pseudonym. But the fact is, there's something quite interesting there, you know, because, I mean, the story is about, it's called Giving, but, you know, the giving becomes very sinister.
Yes.
Because it's basically a love triangle, isn't it? With you know, it's told by the wife. The husband is having an affair with a younger woman. Very classic situation. But what isn't classic is that the wife, rather than kind of confronting the younger woman or confronting the husband, she starts sending presents to the husband. To the husband's lover.
To the lover, right.
The lover. She sends presents. She sends the kind of things her husband might be giving that woman, except that he isn't, of course. He isn't giving her anything. So that means the lover is saying, the lover thinks they're from him, you know.
Right,
so
and then he becomes very suspicious of who is sending them.
Yeah, exactly. And then she starts, and then it becomes sinister and darker because, you know, the wife starts sending the lover more and more unpleasant things.
Right.
So then but they still seem to be coming from the husband, you know, and so it's kind of, it would be like 120 pages, a novella, you know, and it could be quite interesting to do.
I think it really would be interesting. It reminded me in a very different way, because this is a very different book, but it reminded me a little bit of Margaret Atwood's The Blind Assassin. She has stories embedded within, and it's just very it's interesting.
And that's not one of those I've read, but...
Oh, wow, it's pretty fantastic. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting sort of architecturally in that same way. Rupert, I always like to ask people what they've read lately that they might recommend to listeners. Have you read any books by other authors that you would recommend?
Oh, I have five. I knew you were going to ask this. So I have five things here.
Oh, wonderful. And
because I'm one of those people who I didn't make it very easy for myself during the lockdown, you know, since the virus has started. When the virus started in March last year, I decided to read some of the books that I thought I should have read. And some of the books that I'd started but had never been able to continue with, you know, found too difficult. So the first one is Moby Dick.
Oh, wow. Boy, you really did. You went back.
Yeah. I mean, Moby Dick, though, I have to say, because I tried about five or six times over the years to get into that, and I never could. And this time I kept going and I kept going, and it's so worth it. It's an extraordinary book because, you know, there's really no story. I mean, there's nothing much happens, even though it's what, you know, it's like, I'm just looking, it's more than 600 pages, but it's just extraordinary in its language, I think, and its evocation of, you know, I really felt like I was on that ship. And one night I couldn't sleep, which very rarely happens with me, but I was staying in another person, someone else's, my brother-in-law's house, and had an ensuite bathroom and with a heated floor, which I'm not used to that kind of luxury, you know. So I left my wife in bed and went into the bathroom, closed the door, and I sat on the heated floor and I read Moby Dick for 2 hours between about 3 a.m. and 5 a.m.
Wow.
And it was absolutely as if I was on that ship, you know, the Pequod. And the language is really Shakespearean at some points, you know, very ornate and very beautiful, and not actually at all what I was expecting. You know, he goes into monologues, characters go into monologues, and it's an extraordinary book full of extraordinary images. So, you know, that's one I would say.
Wonderful.
Another difficult book I read was I don't know whether you've heard of Vasily Grossman, Life and Fate.
Nope.
He's a Ukrainian Jewish writer who wrote under Stalin. The book was bad, you know, he wasn't allowed to publish the book in his lifetime because it was anti-Stalin, basically. He had a lot of trouble with the KGB, and the book was finally published in 1964. But it's called Life and Fate, and it's set during the Battle of Stalingrad. And it's another massive book, which is, I think, what put me off. You know, this one's kind of 700 pages plus. Mm. But the most extraordinary panoramic novel, you know, in the sense that there are real people in it, there are fictional characters, you know, Hitler appears, Stalin appears, but also there are all these fictional characters, and you one moment you're in a concentration camp, the next you're on the front in Stalingrad itself, and extraordinarily vivid writing and a kind of masterpiece, I think, a bit of a forgotten masterpiece. Mm-hmm. And then shall I mention one more?
Sure.
Who's this German writer who I've discovered in the last couple of years called Jenny Erpenbeck. And I just read a book called Visitation by her. It's really the story of a house that takes place over 100 years. And it's all the people who pass through the house. And again, it goes through the Second World War pretty much up to the present day. But it's a house in East Germany, in Brandenburg, a rather beautiful house near a lake. She's... I think also an extraordinary writer, you know, one of the best contemporary fiction writers around. I mean, I do try and read as much fiction in translation as I can, you know, because I think some of the most interesting writing is happening in other languages.
Right, right. The other press is wonderful for that. I love
it's such an eclectic range, isn't it? Like when you open up their catalogue, it's like you'll find a novel from South Korea or a memoir from Argentina, you know, it's so global in its reach.
Yeah, you must be happy to be with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so do you know, other than giving as a possibility, do you know what you're writing next?
Oh, yeah, I started a book on Valentine's Day last year. So again, just before the virus hit. So, you know, I'm not one of those writers who have been paralyzed by the pandemic, quite the reverse. I found it really productive.
Yeah.
Because you know, there are all those drinks parties you don't have to go to anymore. All those people you don't have to see that you maybe didn't want to see, but you felt you should.
Right.
And so there seems to be so much time. And of course, I've been able to fill that time. So I've been kind of pretty much working 8-9 hour days. I've been working longer days than I normally would.
Yeah.
So I'm already on the fifth draft of something new.
Oh, wonderful.
Which is funny, which is interesting in the sense that as Barcelona Dreaming is just pre-crash, you know, pre the 2008-9 crash, the book I'm working on now is just pre-pandemic. So it's basically about, I can't really say too much about it, except that it's about a historian in his early 50s who is coming back from a conference in Norway, and he has a kind of psychotic experience.
Oh, wow.
On the train to the airport. Okay. And that sends him off in a direction that he wasn't expecting.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Wonderful. Well, that's great. All right, I just really have one last question. And I always like to finish up with a question that might offer some advice for listeners who are writers. And in your case, I thought I would return to that, the visit that Mar makes to Amy, the daughter, in your first story in this, in Barcelona Dreaming. And my question is about middles. So I felt like that was just this lovely transition into what happens next, you know, because Amy and Abdel meet and they start a friendship that becomes more of a relationship, something that she's not quite sure what's happening. And then right as that's at the beginning, her daughter comes to visit. And so it kind of changes the tone of the book. It offers new character. It offers a little backstory. Lots of wonderful things happen when Mar comes to visit. And I just wonder if you can talk about writing a story arc and finding that wonderful transition that brings us into the middle of something. And you know, maybe for people who are a little stuck, what they're going to do in the middle of their piece.
Oh, it's so difficult to talk about in a way, because as I almost suggested at the beginning, you know, so much of what happens
is intuitive,
the kind of mystery to me.
Right.
You know, you when you described that, I was listening to it, and it made me sound quite clever. You know, like I'd done something quite clever in bringing Mar back to stay at that moment. But from my point of, from where I'm standing, I simply thought Mar has to come and visit her mother because it's the holidays. You know, she would come back to stay with her mother in the holidays, and that is clearly going to interrupt everything. I guess I also thought that what's great about the daughter coming back is that it gives a kind of, it builds a tension into the story, because you think, is Amy going to use this as an excuse to end the relationship with Abdel? You know, is it going to give her the kind of breathing space to think, what you're doing is crazy? You know, you have to stop now, and this is a great place to stop before it's gone too far. Or will she think, I miss him so much, I have to see him? You know, I mean, which way will she go with that? So I think one of the most important things in fiction is pacing and tension. You know, and by tension, I don't mean suspense. I mean simply that the reader is sort of driven forwards by something. Right. You know, they're propelled forwards by something. And it doesn't have to be, it can simply be the way one sentence leads to another. You know, the writers I love most and return to most are writers that I think that Christine Scott describes as sentence magicians.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful phrase. And it's something that I would hope sort of, I would love to be said about me, you know, because I spend all my time on the construction of sentences and how one sentence moves into the next one, how it can follow or how it could not follow, you know, how you can create tension simply by moving from one sentence to the next. So I don't know whether that answers your question.
It does. No, it's great.
It's also I hate to say this to all the writers out there, but I've never had this thing called writer's block.
You don't get stuck in the middle.
Because I work every day, and if I write, I mean, this is also advice, I guess, for writers, would-be writers, because it's so important to be in contact with the work, whatever it is that you're working on. You know, you should always be in contact with it, and you should always be putting words down on the screen or on paper, however you want to do it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if the words are wrong or embarrassing, you know, or kind of laughable, you know, it doesn't matter, because no one has to see those words. And if you work on those words and work on them, they won't be like that anymore. They'll get better. So it's a lonely way to make your living, although it's actually not even a way to make your living necessarily, but it's a lonely way to live, you know, because you necessarily have to spend a lot of time by yourself, and you have to like being by yourself. You know, I can't wait to get to the desk most days. You know, I just love entering that world, and I love the making of sentences. Couldn't live without it.
That's fantastic.
I was going to read something out as well about advice to a writer, because I just think this is great. A Danish writer called Isaac Dinesen.
Yes.
She wrote Out of Africa, but she wrote these amazing, a book I always return to is called Seven Gothic Tales. These amazing, mysterious stories that I can never really understand or make sense of.
Right.
But in one of those stories, there's this brilliant thing where she says, be not afraid of absurdity. Do not shrink from the fantastic. Within a dilemma, choose the most unheard of, the most dangerous solution. Be brave, be brave. I just thought that's really nice advice.
I like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to just mention again, the name of the book is Barcelona Dreaming by Rupert Thompson, published by The Other Press, and coming out June 1st. So thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Shayla. My pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Rupert Thompson about his new book, Barcelona Dreaming, published by The Other Press and coming out on June 1st. You can learn more about his work at otherpress.com. He tweets at RupertThompson1. That's the number one, and there's no P in Thompson. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my conversation with Rupert Thompson, who quotes Christine Scott as writing about sentence magicians, people who write beautiful sentences and change their work significantly through focusing on language and really concentrating on their sentences. Rupert also mentions Mary Gateskill, Joy Williams, Dennis Johnson, and of course the classics, William Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor, as some of his favorite sentence magicians. So this week's Write the Book prompt is to focus on your sentences and try to make them as unique and interesting and succinct or rolling or flowing or whatever your work needs. Focus on your sentences and don't stop looking at them until you're really satisfied with them and you feel that they are serving the work as best they can. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. So here we are. It's almost June. So I encourage you to support the authors who are launching books while the pandemic is still going on. Try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours are being canceled. I hope that you personally are able to read and to write. And if you're a writer and you're trying to put words on the page, keep in mind that we have weekly writing prompts on the show, and that the archives of the show list all those writing prompts to help you in your work. I would love your feedback about Write the Book. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, rate it in iTunes or wherever you get it. Like it on Facebook and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.